you see the sunshine or whether you don't, doesn't make an awful lot of difference at the moment. I think the high for Scotland and Northern Ireland, again, around about 13 or 14. Neil, I wish you a peaceful night.
And to you, Phil. Many thanks indeed. The Nobel laureate Seamus Heaney died recently. In this recording, the poet reads the ninth part of his translation of Beowulf. Beowulf has ruled the Geats, well, for 50 years, 50 winters, rather. Then an intruder breaks into a sleeping dragon's lair and steals from his treasure trove. Awakened, the angry dragon emerges, belching out flames. To defend his people, Beowulf takes up the sword again and attacks the dragon.
It wasn't long until the fierce contenders clashed again. The horde guard took heart, inhaled and swelled up and got a new wind. He who had once ruled was furled in fire and had to face the worst. No help or backing was to be had then from his high-born comrades. That hand-picked troop broke ranks and ran for their lives to the safety of the wood. But within one heart, sorrow welled up. In a man of worth, the claims of kinship cannot be denied. His name was Wiglaf, a son of Weostans, a well-regarded Scylfing warrior related to Alfheri. When he saw his lord tormented by the heat of his scalding helmet, he remembered the bountiful gifts bestowed on him, how well he lived among the Wegmundings, the freehold he inherited from his father before him. He could not hold back. One hand brandished the yellow timbered shield, the other drew his sword. It was his first time to be tested as a fighter. His spirit did not break, and the ancestral blade would keep its edge, as the dragon discovered as soon as they came together in the combat. Sad at heart, addressing his companions, Wiglaf spoke wise and fluent words. I remember that time when mead was flowing, how we pledged loyalty to our lord in the hall, promised our ring-giver we would be worth our price, make good the gift of the war gear, these swords and helmets, as and when his need required it. Now the day has come when this lord we serve needs sound men to give him their support. Let us go to him, help our leader through the hot flame and dread of the fire. As God is my witness, I would rather my body were robed in the same burning blaze as my gold-giver's body than go back home bearing arms. That is unthinkable, unless we have first slain the foe and defended the life of the Prince of the Weathergeats. I well know the things he has done for us deserve better. Why should he alone be left exposed to fall in battle? We must bond together, shield and helmet, mail shirt and sword. Then he waded the dangerous reek and went under arms to his lord, saying only, go on, dear Beowulf, do everything you said you would when you were still young and vowed you would never let your name and fame be dimmed while you lived. Your deeds are famous, so stay resolute, my lord. Defend your life now with the whole of your strength. I shall stand by you. After those words, a wildness rose in the dragon again and drove it to attack, heaving up fire, hunting for enemies, the humans it loathed. Flames lapped the shield, charred it to the boss, and the body armour on the young warrior was useless to him. But Wiglaf did well under the wide rim Beowulf shared with him, once his own had shattered in sparks and ashes. Inspired again by the thought of glory, the war king threw his whole strength behind a sword stroke and connected with the skull. And Nagling snapped. Beowulf's ancient iron-grey sword let him down in the fight. It was never his fortune to be helped in combat by the cutting edge of weapons made of iron. When he wielded a sword, no matter how blooded and hard-edged the blade, his hand was too strong. The stroke he dealt, I have heard, would ruin it. He could reap no advantage. Then the bane of that people, the fire-breathing dragon, was mad to attack for a third time. When a chance came, he caught the hero in a rush of flame and clamped sharp fangs into his neck. Beowulf's body ran wet with his lifeblood. It came welling out. Next thing, they say, the noble son of Weohstan saw the king in danger at his side and displayed his inborn bravery and strength. He left the head alone, but his fighting hand was burned when he came to his kinsman's aid. He lunged at the enemy lower down so that his decorated sword sank into its belly and the flames grew weaker. Once again the king gathered his strength and drew a stabbing knife he carried on his belt, sharpened for battle. He stuck it deep into the dragon's flank. Beowulf dealt it a deadly wound. They had killed the enemy. Their courage quelled his life. That pair of kinsmen, partners in nobility, had destroyed the foe. So every man should act, be at hand when needed. But now, for the king, this would be the last of his many labours and triumphs in the world. Then the wound dealt by the ground burner earlier began to scald and swell. Beowulf discovered deadly poison suppurating inside him, surges of nausea, and so, in his wisdom, the prince realized his state and proceeded towards a seat on the rampart. He steadied his gaze on those gigantic stones, saw how the earthwork was braced with arches built over columns. And now that thane, unequalled for goodness, with his own hands washed his lord's wounds, swabbed the weary prince with water, bathed him clean, unbuckled his helmet. Beowulf spoke. In spite of his wounds, mortal wounds, he still spoke, for he well knew his days in the world had been lived out to the end. His allotted time was drawing to a close. Death was very near. Now is the time when I would have wanted to bestow this armour on my own son, had it been my fortune to have fathered an heir and live on in his flesh. For 50 years I ruled this nation. No king of any neighbouring clan would dare face me with troops. None had the power to intimidate me. I stood my ground and took what came, cared for things in my keeping, never fomented quarrels, never swore to a lie. All this consoles me. Go now quickly, dearest Wiglaf, under the grey stone where the dragon is laid out, lost to his treasure. Hurry to feast your eyes on the hoard. Away you go. I want to examine the ancient gold, gaze my fill on those garnered jewels. My going will be easier for having seen the treasure, a less troubled letting go of the life and lordship I have long maintained. And so I have heard the son of Weohstan quickly obeyed the command of his languishing, war-weary lord. He went in his chain mail under the rock-piled roof of the barrow, exulting in his triumph, and saw beyond the seat a treasure trove of astonishing richness, wall hangings that were a wonder to behold, glittering gold spread across the ground, the old dawn-scorching serpent's den packed with goblets and vessels from the past, tarnished and corroding, rusty helmets all eaten away, armbands everywhere, artfully wrought. How easily treasure buried in the ground, gold hidden however skilfully, can escape from any man. And he saw too a standard, entirely of gold, hanging high over the hoard, a masterpiece of filigree. It glowed with light, so he could make out the ground at his feet and inspect the valuables. Of the dragon there was no remaining sign. The sword had dispatched him. The one who had for long minded the hoard, hovering over gold, unleashing fire, surging forth midnight after midnight, had been mown down. Wiglaf went quickly, keen to get back, excited by the treasure. Anxiety weighed on his brave heart. He was hoping he would find the leader of the Geats alive, for he had left him, helpless, earlier, on the open ground. So he came to the place, carrying the treasure, and found his lord bleeding profusely, his life at an end. Again he began to swab his body. The beginnings of an utterance heaved up from the coffers of the king's heart. The old lord gazed sadly at the gold. To the everlasting Lord of all, to the King of glory, I give thanks that I behold this treasure here in front of me, that I have been allowed to leave my people so well endowed on the day I die. Now that I have bartered my last breath to own this fortune, it is up to you to look after their needs. I can hold out no longer. Order my troop to construct a barrow on a headland on the coast, after my pyre has cooled. It will loom on the horizon at Hrón's Ness, and be a reminder among my people, so that in coming times crews under sail will call it Beowulf's Barrow as they steer ships across the wide and shrouded waters. Then the king, in his great-heartedness, unclasped the collar of gold from his neck and gave it to his young thane, telling him to use it and the war shirt and the gilded helmet. You are the last of us, the only one left of the Wegmundings. Fate swept us away, sent my whole brave high-born clan to their final doom. Now I must follow. That was the warrior's last word. He had no more to confide. The furious heat of the pyre would assail him. His soul fled from his breast to its destined place among the steadfast ones. It was hard then on the young hero, having to watch the one he held so dear there on the ground, going through his death agony. The dragon from under earth, his nightmarish destroyer, lay destroyed as well, utterly without life. He lay there rigid, brought low beside the treasure lodge. Never again would he glitter and glide and show himself off in the midnight air, exulting in his riches. He fell to earth through the battle strength in Beowulf's arm. The treasure had been won, bought and paid for by Beowulf's death. Both had reached the end of the road through the life they had been lent. Before long, the battle dodgers abandoned the wood. The ones who had let their lord down earlier, the tail-turners, 10 of them together. When he needed them most, they had made off. Now they were ashamed and came behind shields in their battle outfits to where the old man lay. They watched Wiglaf sitting worn out, a comrade shoulder to shoulder with his lord, trying in vain to bring him round with water. Much as he wanted to, there was no way he could preserve his lord's life on earth, or alter in the least the Almighty's will. What God judged right would rule what happened to every man, as it does to this day.
Seamus Heaney was reading from his translation of Beowulf, and you can hear the final part of the story at the same time tomorrow morning. Beowulf was produced in Salford by Susan Roberts. Now here's Sailing By to take us to the shipping forecast. Now, on BBC Radio 4, it's time for the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Friday, the 11th of October. There are warnings of gales in Tyne, Dogger, Fisher, German Bight, Humber, Thames, Dover, Wight and Portland. The general synopsis at 1800, low, German Bight 1007, moving southwest, losing its identity by 1800 Friday. New low expected at Dover 1013 by same time. High, Rockall 1033, expected Fair Isle 1035 by same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, north at Sarah, south at Sarah. Northerly or northeasterly 4 or 5, occasionally 6, fair, good. Forties, Cromarty, 4th. Northeast 5 to 7.